Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware, in case any of you are not, of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. In my broadcast, some of you have noticed that you hear very little about financial support, and that's deliberate. We really trust God here on that score and firmly believe that God pays for what He orders. The same policy is true in my local church ministry. Other than the teaching we offer on these broadcasts, over the years I have done a good deal of writing, as time allows, to prepare resources that I think should be helpful to my congregation and also helpful to you, our listeners. But on this program, I don't say a lot about those resources, much as I don't say a lot about finances, and I guess that omission in terms of resources kind of defeats the purpose. So grab a pen and paper and get prepared to write down a website. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the five books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage, Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of the book of Genesis. In fact, we will close out this exposition with this particular message. It's been a long ride, but I hope you found it an edifying, informative, and occasionally inspirational one. We have already introduced chapter 49 in our last segment. We find Jacob summoning his sons in anticipation of his imminent demise. When they've all assembled, Jacob starts with Reuben, his eldest. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, and all of a sudden collapse. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it. You went up to my couch, the horror of it all. He heaps up majestic praise on Reuben As one writer said, it builds up to an ignominious collapse. It reflects exalted hopes that were shattered at Reuben's fall, narrated back in 35:22. That's when he violated his father's marital bed with Rachel's servant, Bilhah. Kidner says it would be hard to find a more withering contrast between a man and his calling. A sad story of disappointed hope, one not uncommon. It's a familiar story. Chickens do come home to roost. Reuben was a man ruled by passion rather than moral principles. We mean he proved as morally unstable as water. That's what Jacob was talking about, uncontrolled as water. And the character fountain of the father, the headwater, passed to some degree into its biological tributaries, the sons. So as things played out in the nation, as things evolved, his tribe, the tribe of Reuben, fell far short of its promise. That was the prediction, and that outcome came to pass. The tribe of Reuben never shone in the grand scheme of things. In verses 5 through 7, a prophecy about Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council, nor my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. These are prophecies. Jacob is speaking under the influence of the Spirit of God. The hot and violent nature of these two sons that showed itself in the massacre of the Shechemites was a great stain upon those two men. They were the architects of a horrific slaughter that Jacob condemned at the time. Not only the slaughter of the men of Shechem, whom they had deceived, but we remember it extended to the laming of innocent animals. It betrayed in these two brothers a streak in the headwaters of the spirits of those two that caused Jacob to prophesy that God would not allow them, meaning their tribes, to be concentrated in strength in the nation. When the nation was finally formed and settled in the Promised Land centuries later, these two tribes, descendant from these two brothers, Simeon and Levi, would in fact be dispersed for purposes of dilution of their hot passion. As it turned out, the tribe of Simeon eventually got absorbed into Judah, and the tribe of Levi became the priestly tribe, and its members were dispersed by God's plan through Levitical cities located all over Israel. Verse 8 through 12, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand will be upon the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who dares rouse him up? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine, and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull or dark from wine, and his teeth white from milk. A lot of prophetic space is devoted to Judah. That's because the two tribes of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, would receive blessings of great wealth and space. But the tribe of Judah would, Jacob predicts, emerge with ascendancy. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he to whom it belongs, namely the Messiah, shall come, and the obedience of the nations shall be his. Much glory would attach itself to Judah, and Judah would flourish like a man with the best of vineyards. In verse 13, Zebulun shall dwell at the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank will be toward Sidon. In Jacob's prophecy, he sees Zebulun's future, a tribe with access to the sea, to take profitable advantage of maritime commerce. Jacob also predicts what he could never have known centuries before, that Zebulun would reside in territory where his border would extend toward Sidon. That prophecy is truly remarkable. Only by inspiration of the Holy Spirit could Jacob have known all this hundreds of years previous. Issachar, spoken of in 14 through 15, in Issachar Jacob sees a tribe too willing to sacrifice the dignity of its independence for the material things of life. In a way, Issachar will share the spirit of a serf. Dan will be a judge among the tribes of Israel, 16 and 17, an arbiter of justice. But Dan will also have a dark side. Though a small tribe, Dan will prove dangerous, as cunning as a snake in the grass. In Dan, Jacob predicts another case of a gap between calling or vocation and achievement, between potential for good and actual performance. Verse 18 is a petition for God's deliverance, an unexpected interjection of a petition as Jacob, in the spirit of prophecy, foresees some dangers and challenges facing his descendants. Gad, verse 19, would be located in vulnerable territory on the east side of Jordan, adjacent to the hostile Moabite, and always having to fend off enemy incursions. But he predicts, like an angry dog, Gad would be a very defensive tribe, possessive of its territory and capable of warding them off. Speaks of Asher in verse 20, a prediction and a picture of positioning on a fertile plain with trade routes to the sea. Only the Spirit of God could have anticipated this location of the tribe of Asher. This tribe would produce food and delicacies fit for a king, such as Israel would eventually have, a king. Asher would be a sort of breadbasket of royal supply. He says of Naphtali in verse 21, Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Kidner says this free mountain people will breed true and keep its character. Verses 22 through 26, he speaks of Joseph, a fruitful bough by the spring, its branches run over the wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm, his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and by the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lie beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, really, Ephraim and Manasseh, and on the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. The prophetic blessings of fruitfulness for the two tribes. In war, they would be a handful in battle situations, and that turned out to be the case. Not because of his natural endowments, but because the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because he would help you and bless you with blessings of the skies above and of springs below and of the breast and the womb. Joseph would be the prince among his brothers, and would at least enjoy supremacy with the 10 northern tribes, though the ruler, through whom the Messiah would come out of Judah. Verse 27, he speaks of Benjamin. Benjamin, as a tribe, would be wolf-like with a warrior spirit. That was an accurate characterization, as it turned out over time. King Saul and his brave son Jonathan were of the tribe of Benjamin. And in verses 29 through 32, Jacob gives to his sons his burial instructions. They are to inter him with his fathers in the cave in the field of Ephron the Hittite, a cave in the field of Machpelah, near Mamre in Cana. That field and cave Abraham purchased as a burial site. That is a spot sacred to Jacob. That is the spot where Isaac had buried Rebekah his wife, and where Jacob buried Leah. That purchase from the Hittites was symbolic to Jacob. It was just a toehold on the land God had promised the patriarchs. Hence, it was very sacred to him. And with that, verse 33, Jacob drew his feet up into his bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people, that is, his ancestors who had gone before him. Which brings us to chapter 50, the last chapter in the book. Then Joseph fell upon his father's face, and he wept over him, and he kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. Now 40 days were required for it, for such is the period required for embalming by the famed Egyptian process. And the Egyptians, who identified so much with Joseph, and consequently his family, at this time, this is early on, the whole story will change later. The Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of mourning for Jacob were passed, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your sight, please speak to Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am about to die. In my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Cana, there you shall bury me. Now therefore, please let me go up and bury my father. Then I will return. The mourning for Jacob among the Egyptians was truly like that of a king. It was 70 days. After all that was over, Joseph indirectly asked Pharaoh for permission to return the body of his father to Canaan, to the family burial ground, at his father's dying request, and on an oath. After that, Joseph promises to return to his duties in Egypt. That oath, Pharaoh understands. He respected it, and Joseph was granted permission to lead what amounted to a royal cortege to Canaan. In all of these narratives, we see the immense respect accorded to Joseph from Pharaoh on down throughout the royal court. I've said again and again, it's remarkable the testimony, the stature that Joseph, in those early days of Israel's sojourning, had among the people of Egypt and with Pharaoh. And we have to remember, Egypt has a long history, and this Pharaoh was not the Pharaoh that ultimately enslaved the Israelites when it became very threatened by their population explosion. Totally different picture. Over time, things change, and they radically changed in Egypt where the Israelites were concerned. In my lifetime, I've seen radical changes in our country. It's amazing how historical winds can shift and different personalities in seats of power can make such a difference. In this day, everything was positive, and Joseph was in the highest standing, as were the people of Israel. It was a very stately procession. It included not only all of Jacob's family, but, get this, all of Pharaoh's court officials, which, as I said, tells us much about the high esteem in which Joseph was held among the Egyptians. Pharaoh said in verse 6, "Go up and bury your father as he made you swear." So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his, Pharaoh's household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the household of Joseph, and his brothers, and his father's household. They left behind only their little ones, and their flocks, and their herds, in the land of Goshen. There also went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. And when they came to the threshing floors of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, they stopped there, they lamented there for a very great and sorrowful lamentation. This was a slow-moving funeral procession. He observed 7 days mourning for his father. It made an impression on the people of the land. Now when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians." Therefore it was named Abel Mitzrayim. That meant the meadow or the mourning of Egypt. And thus his sons did for him, verse 12, as he had charged them. So in verses 10 and 11, there's a mute historical witness in the time of Moses to this grand procession of mourning. That name, Abel Mitzrayim, means the mourning of the Egyptians. Now Moses, the narrator, says, you know how the name of that particular place came to be. The Canaanites, who were then in the possession of the land, gave that place that name when they witnessed this great cortege and all of that grief. Verses 12 through 14 relate how Joseph followed the last wishes of his father to a T. For as we mentioned earlier, his wishes were intended to make a tacit statement of Jacob's indomitable faith in God's promise that his descendants would inherit the land. But the Canaanites, looking on, had no clue about that, you can be sure. Well, once Jacob had died and was buried, we see something very interesting, very interesting. When Joseph's brothers, verse 15, saw that their father had died, they said, here we go again, what if Joseph should bear a grudge against us and pay us back for all the wrong that we did to him? So they sent a message to Joseph saying, your father charged before he died, saying, thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. But now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father. What was Joseph's response? Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Once Jacob had died and was buried, Joseph's brothers experienced a resurgence of that long-buried guiltiness for the way they had treated him. It's amazing how guilt tends to hang around. Although they had, in a nonverbal way, seemed to acknowledge their guilt, it had all stopped short of just coming clean verbally and admitting openly and clearly how bad it was. Joseph knew they were ashamed, he knew they were sorry, and that permitted reconciliation on Joseph's part. But you know something? Until they verbally and honestly confessed it to him, fear, owing to some residual guiltiness, would remain hanging around on the psychological premises. That's why in counseling people, if someone says, "I'm sorry," it's good to ask, "Sorry for what?" Get it out of them at the unvarnished level that the sin and the guilt exist. Don't say, "I made a mistake." Say, "I sinned." What is the sin? Say it. Spell it out. Only in that way can you really get clearing. Now his brothers started to wonder if perhaps Joseph had been maybe holding back revenge until their father had had time to pass. Maybe now, secretly nursing a grudge. Might be payback time for all the wrongs we did to him. So apparently, being a little chicken-hearted through an unidentified intermediary, they relayed the last deathbed request to Joseph from Jacob. Namely, the request that Joseph, for the sake of his father, forgive their brothers of their sins and wrongs which they had committed in treating him so badly. Then, in their own request, they asked Joseph forgive them one and all for the sins of the servants of the God of your father. Receiving their request caused Joseph to weep. It touched an emotional nerve. Stuff he thought was all behind the family. Now he discovers in the wake of his father's death that it's still rattling around in their emotional cages. That meant that wounds he hoped were healed were still a sensitive spot for them. Therefore, with those fears in the family mix, their relationship or sense of closeness to him, he suddenly discovered were not exactly what he hoped for. There was still work to do. Better understanding of the realities to be achieved before things were totally level. That is evident when they finally come to him, throw themselves down before him, as if this action might assuage a vengeful spirit and offer themselves as his slaves. They didn't get it. When they told Joseph in verse 18, "Behold, we are your servants," Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in God's place? As for you, okay, you meant evil against me way back there. But God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I'll provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Joseph gives his brothers some helpful theological perspective. There was no need for them to fear him. He is not God. It's not his place to exact revenge for personal wrongs or injuries. Joseph is very honest. "Yes, it's true. At that time, you did mean what you did to me for harm. But behind it all, I recognize the sovereign hand of God. He used your bad intentions for good purposes. Namely, as you can all see, saving many lives. So I get that. I hope you get it too. The fact that you're truly repentant clears it in the sight of God, and therefore in my sight as well. That's the unspoken thought here. So relax." He spoke kindly to them and reassured them that it was his intention not to punish them, but to provide for them and their children according to the will of God. So we see Joseph and all of Jacob's family stayed in Egypt. Joseph himself was there almost 100 years, dying at an age the Egyptians, we are told, considered the ideal term of life, 110 years. He lived long enough to see the third generation of Ephraim's children, and also appeared to adopt Machir, the son of Manasseh. As Joseph was about to die, he instructed his brothers, as did Jacob, to swear on a solemn oath that whenever they went out of Egypt, as God had promised they would, made them promise that they would take his bones with them as a witness to the faithfulness of God's promise to bury them there. That oath was fulfilled when the Israelites took the promised land and buried Joseph's bones at Shechem, Joshua 24, verse 32. Well, thank you, dear friends, for being with us through this study. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.